And this would be the time to open it up for questions. Anybody have questions for any of our presenters? Yes.
There's some study that looked at the flow variables, and then some just looked at smoking, because they had complaints of all that thing. So some did look at BMI and stresses, stressing their life and all that there. But the strongest association of those and smoking, where they took those variables.
I'm going to just ask a follow-up question regarding smoking. I'm intrigued by the emerging evidence of the health risks associated with e-cigarettes and vaping. Is there any suggestion that that form of smoking might be related to back pain in one way or another, or is it just too soon to tell? Okay. Thank you. This question in the back, Jim?
I have a few questions about vitamin D. The first is, what's the best way to assess vitamin D levels so we know what dose is appropriate and personalized alteration? And the second would be, is it a good idea to reduce our use of sunblock to increase our vitamin D?
Those are both great questions. The serum, to address your first question, serum levels of 25-hydroxy-D are what are the most accepted and recommended measures. The Institute of Medicine kind of has set the standard that 30 nanograms per milliliter is the acceptable level, and anything below 20 is insufficient. But there's a lot of evidence that may be insufficient, actually, especially when you're talking about other health outcomes like cancer and cardiovascular disease, that actually going for a level of more like 50 nanograms per milliliter is a better predictor of health. But there aren't a lot of high-quality studies that support that at this point that I saw. So checking for 25-hydroxy-D in the serum is really the way to go, and looking for at least 30, a level of 30. And the second question, should we stop using sunscreen? So in order to get adequate vitamin D, the guidelines are 20 minutes of sun exposure of 80% of your skin daily between the high sun hours. So that's, depending on the time of year, like noon to 2. So most of us, aren't going to go out in our bathing suits at that time. Whether or not we should seems to depend on risk factors. So someone who's had a history of skin cancer or is fair-skinned or has a family history probably shouldn't do that. So I personally haven't seen studies that kind of take those two aspects and combine them. I think that's an excellent question, and personally I look at my patients. My personal approach is to look at my patients and their risk factors and kind of help them decide where to go with that. I think supplementing with vitamin D, because it's so inexpensive and the risk is minimal, make that, you know, and you don't have the risk of skin cancer. That's a good point. Also, something else that's interesting is that people who are vegans, individuals who are vegans, may not want to take D3, which is the most effective form of D. So they will opt for D2, because D3 is generally an animal-based product. And there are some studies that show that that is effective, but not as effective as D3. That's kind of a segue.
In the back, Mike.
I'm not sure if you said it, but what percentage of your current practice smokes? And then the other follow-up to that would be, do you use any health communication techniques to gauge the individual's readiness to change and once you identify that there is a correlation to smoking and back pain? And then the third follow-up would be, do you use any locks, frame, messaging in your office to emphasize the connection of back pain and smoking?
During the intake process in the Naval Hospital, we do ask if they drink alcohol and smoke and check out the plaques. And I'll see about 4 or 5 a week out of Vancouver. Close to 20 new patients a week. I don't know, that's, you know, they do come with back pain, so it's a higher prevalence there. I don't know, I can't answer your first question where the general the population that we serve are smokers. There's just, I know, about 4 or 5 out of 20 are smokers with back pain. So, that's my answer, yes. Your next question was,
do you help you? Techniques to identify their readiness to change when you identify that they are smoking.
We do ask if they're aware that there's programs in the hospital that will help them quit smoking, and yes or no there, if they're interested in finding out more information. I don't think we have anything official in place at the clinic that we're at, but the hospital does have smoking cessation programs. And that I can find him make a referral for them to start. Some have already tried too, and they confess that they tried to quit many times. So, but the back pain always, I don't know, they kind of wake up because it's something that's real to them right now. And cancer is down the road, maybe, I don't know, you know. 20, 30 years from now. I'm gonna talk about, going through my public health program, I did a study on the use of fear in health promotion. And within that study, there's the extreme fear where you're gonna die of cancer and all that. And they found that it wasn't really effective when you talk about extreme fear, because they think that's not gonna happen to me. And then on the other side of the spectrum, it's no fear at all, just, nothing. So what they found was most effective is when you spoke to patients in front of you and talk about counseling on smoking, and the immediate effects of smoking, which they concluded was like the bad breath. You have bad breath. And now there's the smell of smoke in your clothing, and you just walk around and smell like a smoker or an ashtray, that thing. But what's exciting about the study is now we can talk about a new thing that's in front of you now is back pain. And I think Dr. Wayne for this study.
I'll suggest that you might want to look at Cheryl Hawk. She's published the Readiness to Change Ruler. That would engage where a patient is, and you can use the transcutaneous monitor change for chest to decline and move that patient through it. And then on top of that, you use the 5 A's and the 5 R's to move that patient through that process.
Thank
you. Jonathan, you had a question?
Yeah, I had a question for Dr. Zaza. As I was listening to what you're describing makes kind of intuitive sense, but I was wondering if the graphs were a little bit of apples and oranges. The reason being, I think you asked about the number of chiros in counseling versus number of visits for medicine, which isn't the same measure. And like the other one is number of patients versus number of visits. And just wondering if you could talk about that, because they're not the same measure either.
Yes. And of course, it was based on, you know, the available data, but yeah, the cohorts didn't really match from one to the other. The two variables are kind of two independent correlations, kind of two studies in one, right? Where what they had in common was the amount of classroom hours of nutrition, and practice patterns just became a wide, you know, it could be measured by, you know, a percent of visits where counseling was provided, or the percent of healthcare professionals. However, I would have loved to have matching cohorts, but it wasn't really a comparison between, you know, chiropractors counsel and a higher percent of visits. It was more, is there a correlation taking kind of 50% as their, you know, baseline, you know, or MDs counseling the majority of visits or the majority of chiropractors counseling. So that was more like two independent numbers we're looking at with individual positive correlations. So, but the both had the classroom hours of nutrition, as, you know, so chiropractors had more classroom hours of nutrition, and that translated into practice patterns where the majority of the chiropractors counseled, where for the medical doctors, they had less, well, five times less the amount of classroom hours of nutrition. That translated into the minority of visits where patients with hypertension were counseled. But yes, hopefully I can get those cohorts to match. But, you know.
Because the classroom hours was very interesting, but it didn't seem like you actually could talk about practice patterns. Because if a chiropractor said, I counsel 60% of my patients, but maybe they only happen 1 out of 10 visits, but the other measure was on number of visits. I don't know if they're the same thing. See what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, if it was a comparison, if I get the data in the future, I'll probably make it as a comparison. But the two studies that preceded it was kind of, you know, they were saying, well, the National Academy of Sciences and the American Society of Home Nutrition were saying, you know, too little classroom hours during medical school, and that wasn't really quantified. So that was more of the topic, you know, just to measure those hours, compare the hours, but then see how individually, separately, how does that manifest into practice pattern. So I wasn't really comparing the practice pattern, I was comparing the classroom hours of nutrition and individually analyze what that translated into as far as practice. But yeah, if we do have those studies in the future, which we don't now, it'll be really interesting to see in what percent of visits do chiropractor counsel for hypertension and cardiovascular disease, and then make a comparison now of the practice pattern. But yeah, but it was based on limitation. I would love to have exact cohorts.
One question here.
So you're asking if there's a relationship between the low intake or lower serum levels of vitamin D in people with darker pigmentation and other outcomes? You know, I can't speak to that directly, but we do know that Black Americans and Hispanic Americans, right, have a higher risk of cardiovascular disease, for example. And by the higher levels of vitamin D, serum vitamin D have been found to be protective for cardiovascular disease. So how much that's associated, I haven't seen anything that directly correlates that, but that might be a factor. But, you know, kind of like what Dr. Cambrum brought up about the comorbidities, there are so many other comorbidities that go with that, obesity and sedentary behavior and poor nutrition. that I can't speak directly to that. But I think that's very interesting, and I do think it's a good reason to get vitamin D levels on patients, especially those who might be at risk. And certainly people with darker pigmentation fit that risk category. Yeah, and you're saying a lot of people who are maybe at a poverty level, that's something they don't even consider. And it's hard for them to get that check, right? Because maybe they don't even have access to care to get that. So it really is, I think, a significant issue.
So it's based on catalogs, came up with 18 program credit programs in the country. I think the data reflects, I think 13 out of 18 where the search was based on the word human nutrition. So, you know, at least 13 teaching individuals set the class. But then I did have two separate tables where I just had clinical nutrition separately. And then I had basic nutrition as a second table, and then I added the two. So the combination between clinical nutrition and basic nutrition. And in the paper, one of the drafts, I compared the clinical nutrition as well, which came up to a high number. I can't remember the exact number now. But the two combined added to under 15. The reason I did that was because Adams, when he measured nutrition hours for medical schools, he was inclusive of, you know, clinical, basic, health inclusive, all the hours they received their medical hours.
Did you notice, like, in our sometimes
definitely had a lower number. So, I mean, I didn't really address the outliers, but yeah, it looked like it had a median, you know, number of classroom hours and a few outliers, which I can't recall right now, that were a couple of standard deviations away from the mean, absolutely.
Another question right here.
One of the studies reported one where people who spoke more frequently tended to have more back pain more often, but that was also countered by some other studies. So I don't think that those response questions have been really addressed well. A lot of it gets lost in the methodology, depending on whether they're looking at a prospective study or a retrospective using, you know, the best available data. So it's probably one of the reasons we see the sort of the cross-canceling of results there.
I know there's some new data coming out that they're being able to basically let that do a genetic test and they can tell how much a person is small. But there's actually now epigenetic changes that they can directly correlate. And I just heard this in the last 3-4 weeks. So it might be interesting down the road from the response perspective.
I had a question for Dr. Stephen Grand. Dr. Grand, you mentioned intermittent fasting as one of the nutritional interventions that might have some protective value with regard to Alzheimer's disease. Can you speak briefly to how that would be applied? Is that something chiropractors might implement in their practice? And how would one go about recommending intermittent fasting for patients?
Yeah, so
Okay. So basically what they mean is taking short bursts of fasting in the midst of normal eating habits. What it does is it kind of helps you reset the metabolism a little bit. So I think basically what we're talking about are, and it didn't go into a lot of detail as to what specific thing that they wanted to do, but I think what they're basically talking about is some, it's similar to calorie restriction in some sense, but you know most of the diets, there's like bad days. There's days where you overeat, or you know, like a junk food day, or, you know, on the weekends it's a little bit different. So it gives your body a little assistance in cleaning out. So when you go into a fast mode, what you're basically doing is giving your body a little bit of rest. So you have a certain amount of energy you produce, and again, this goes to mitochondrial function, but you have a certain amount of energy you produce, and if you utilize that energy on your day-to-day basis, and a lot of it is directed towards the digestive processes. So if you slow that down, you stop for a while, you fast, the energy can be redirected into other avenues.
Thank you. We have time for another question or two, if there are any. And if not, let's thank our presenters one more time. Thanks very much.